You're listening to Naked Oceans with Helen Scales and me, Sarah Castor-Perry. Well, we heard earlier in the show about BirdLife International's work in setting up conservation areas for seabirds across the globe. And that work relies on data collected in the field by researchers about where the birds live, their migration routes, and how they use different parts of the ocean. Well, to find out more about what goes on in the field and how seabirds are studied, I caught up with Andy Wood from the British Antarctic Survey. He's just got back from spending 3 months on Bird Island in South Georgia, where he studies the most impressive flyers on the planet, the wandering albatross. Their wings are the largest that glide through the skies today at around 3 metres or 9 feet wide. And Andy told me how he goes about studying these giant birds.
The way you study them is carefully. I think it's the best way of saying it, because, yes, you've got a bird there with a wingspan of 3-4 metres. Something to give you an idea of the size of it, and if you think of the size of a swan, and it's slightly bigger than that, and you've got to keep that under control if you're going to put some mark on it, like a ring or some other device on it. So, yeah, you treat them with respect, but we've got marked populations of birds at Bird Island. That's down at South Georgia, going back to the late 1950s. So we've been doing it for a few years. Not me personally, but British Antarctic Survey and others have been doing it for quite a lot of years now.
And what sort of things are you attaching to them? Tracking devices, tags?
Yes, all of those. The basic thing for birds is usually a metal ring. And that's what we started off with, a metal ring. We moved to using a plastic ring, because that allows us to identify the bird without disturbing it too much. Birds at Bird Island are very, very tolerant of people. So you can walk up very close to them and they don't really worry that you are there. So with a plastic ring with a number on it, we can read those and just walk around the island and see the birds. And that helps with our perspective. We don't have to handle birds, and the birds don't get stressed out by our presence. So, yeah, we've put rings on the birds, and then we've also moved on to other devices. So we've put satellite transmitters, which allows us to follow them when they're not on the island, because clearly we can only look at the part of their breeding cycle when they're actually on the island and nesting and feeding chicks. And so we put satellite transmitters on them. We've put other smaller devices to collect basically where they go around the world. And where they go is all around the Southern Ocean.
And with the tags, the rings, is that the sort of information you're getting from that, which individuals are breeding together, how many chicks they're having, how long they live, that sort of thing?
Yes, again, all of those. We have a database, as I say, this started off in the late 1950s. We have a database of all the birds at Bird Island and are still coming back to Bird Island. And we know the history of their partners and whether they've changed partners over the years. And what if they produce any chicks, have the chicks come back again? So, yes, we've got a full life history of all the birds at Bird Island.
And what are your conclusions from this kind of data? Are we seeing any changes in their movements, changes in their breeding success?
It takes a long, long time to build up information on a bird. I mean, to just give you some idea of how long these birds live, we've had birds ringed at Bird Island as adults in the 1950s, and they're still coming back again. So they're 50-odd years old, at least. So we've got a long-lived species that breeds, if successful, only every other year. So it produces a chick, hopefully, every 2 years. And from this, we've found out that the population is actually declining. And putting all our other studies together, it's been found that it's longline fishing that's causing the major problem with this species. So lots of other people are trying to work on this particular problem from the fisheries aspect of it, but we're monitoring the long-term population trends of, say, the wandering albatrosses, and I'm afraid it's been on a gradual decline since the 1970s.
And I think perhaps people might not really understand how it is that something that's designed to catch fish will end up catching seabirds. So how exactly do the albatrosses get caught by these longlines?
Okay, I mean, a long line, basically, as the words might suggest, is a long line of hooks, and they are baited hooks, quite often just to catch tuna or those sorts of fish, and they are streamed behind a ship. Now, if you can imagine, there's a time between the hook and the baits coming off the back of the ship and it disappearing into the water and out of the reach of a bird, and it's that time period that's critical, because the bird thinks, ah, there's a free meal here. Unfortunately, the free meal is attached to a hook, and the hook then disappears down into the sea, and that's the end of your albatross.
So are there any sort of practical conservation measures to kind of counteract this sort of bycatch issue?
Oh, yes, there are many, many things that are being put into practice in, if you like, regulated fisheries. And where the fisheries are well controlled, yes, there are lots of things they can do to stop the bycatch of birds on long lines. So they can put streamers behind the ships. They can make the bait sink fast. So, yeah, there are lots and lots of things that are being done. The problem is not all fisheries will put these into action. And it's the unregulated fisheries probably that are causing the most problems these days.
You work on Bird Island, and I suppose it's aptly named because it's not just the albatrosses that breed there. There's all kinds of seabirds that you see there. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the wandering albatrosses there, there's about... eight to 900 pairs there now, but so that's a relatively small number of birds. There are thousands of black-backed albatrosses and grey-headed albatrosses, and other species such as giant petrels, blue petrels, white-chinned petrels. I could go on. So there are many, many, many different species of birds at Bird Island. And I should mention the penguins as well, I suppose. We can't forget the penguins.
So is it an important area for seabird conservation? Is it a protected area?
It is a protected area. The South Georgia government designated a site of special scientific interest, so they restrict who can go there. So, yes, it's a very important area. And particularly that it's rat-free. On South Georgia, the whalers brought along rats, and the rats killed an awful lot of wildlife, and particularly the burrowing petrels. Bird Island has been rat-free and has never had any rats, so we've got all the burrowing petrels and the endemic species, such as the South Georgia pipit, which is quite an interesting small passerine bird that you perhaps wouldn't expect to see on a subantarctic island.
And are you hopeful that some of these conservation strategies, like the managed fisheries and augmenting the longliners so this, they work differently, sink faster, are you hopeful that that might help slow the decline of albatross numbers?
Hopeful. Whether it will actually, and how long the effect might take to come back into the bird populations. Yeah, I mean, all we can do is be positive and, you know, hope that, yes, this will have an effect. But as I say, for a long-lived species, it's going to take a long time before that is going to show back in the populations of Bird Island. And unfortunately, if the current trends carry on, we're going to have no wandering albatrosses at Bird Island in sort of 30 or 40 years.
That was Andy Wood from the British Antarctic Survey introducing the wandering albatrosses of Bird Island in South Georgia. When I spoke to him, he had literally got off a plane, I think, the day before. So it's just obviously... Winter is the time of year in the Northern Hemisphere where you then go to the Southern Hemisphere to do all your field work because it's summer, well, summer down there. So it's obviously a little bit easier to do your work down there than their deep, horrible winters.
I have always wondered what it must be like to spend the winter down in Antarctica. Not sure I want to find out for myself, but extraordinary things nonetheless.